Hi, everybody. You are tuning in the Safe for Brave podcast. I'm the host, Luba Smith, and in this episode, I had a chance to talk with the general manager and CEO of World Gaming and Culture Static, Wim Stocks. The podcast was recorded during Wim's visit of our Prague offices, and I was extremely excited about this opportunity to talk with Wim about the esports industry that is booming right now and his journey to get started in esports business. As part of the Safe or Brave podcast, I like to cover challenging moments in the path to success and the decision thinking of the people that are pushing the envelope to get there. I hope that you will like the podcast. You'll find the Safe or Brave podcast always in your favorite podcasting application and the video version on YouTube. I would appreciate if you like, comment, and subscribe if you have enjoyed the show. Now, let's get to the chat with Wim, the guy that's turning gamers into millionaires. Wim, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And I wanted to start off by asking you, what kind of personality are you? Are you rather safe or brave person?
I think of the two choices, there probably are more than the two, but I think in my both my personal life and my business life and career that I've been more on the brave side, looking to push the envelope for our business, push the envelope for me personally. I think brave would be a better, not always the best decisions, but they were definitely brave decisions. A number that I can speak to, but I think you would find that I'm more on the brave side.
That's great. I love to sort of explore how people challenge their comfort zone and how they achieve the results and the success that they outline and the goals. And I think it's very related to going out of your comfort zone.
Oh, so sure.
It's great to have you and great to do the podcast with you. I think that we'll enjoy it. Could you start off with just a sort of brief description of your early career, how you started, and basically what were the first steps?
When I got out of college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I was a math major. I had a minor in art history. This balance in the those days referred to as liberal arts degrees, which are kind of back in fashion now. But then it was the way to test the waters in a number of different camps. And I knew I didn't want to be an engineer, even though I was a math major, and I went down that path briefly after getting out of college. But I knew that wasn't my long-term goal. Yet it was the foundation for how I got started, and I was in the math realm. This is, and I'm quite a bit older now, and older than you,
a little bit.
But in those days, the notion of computer science was still really relatively new. And as a math major, in the computer, having interest in computer programming was an interest of mine. Although as it turns out, I wasn't very good. But it did programming in the early days did expose me to some very fundamental gaming opportunities, more around the programming. I don't know if Fortran is still around, but a distant sort of distant memory now.
It's not as popular as it used to be.
No, that's right. But we did some very fundamental game programming in Fortran. And it got my interest to sort of the next level as far as electronic gaming is concerned. I also, in my youth, my dad was a collector of pinball machines, and in those days, I used to be able to take a pinball machine apart and put it back together. Very electromagnetic, not really software in those days, but the interest around gaming was really born and birthed out of pinball. And pinball gave rise to the early days of Atari. I was smitten by Pong and Missile Command and some of the Galaxian and other in the early days. But But it really was an amalgam of my interest in math. I was good at math. I can't say that I was interested in it, but I was good at it. I think because I didn't have the interest, my ability to translate that into, you know, engineering and computer science wasn't quite there. But it did propel me on the path towards gaming. From there, when I made the determination I sucked at programming, really went down the path of more technical marketing, being able to articulate and sell technology. Where I went to work right out of college for AT&T. We had a in those days was they were really behind the Unix operating system, and I was part of a team that sold these super minis and super micros, referred to as 3Bs, in the AT&T era, and that also helped me gel my interest in electronic gaming and going beyond. So when it was clear that I shouldn't be a programmer, my pivot was really to the business side. And after leaving AT&T, I went to work for a company that was in the home video business, still in those days, very much a fledgling business. But the software business, as I was explaining last night, was really a garage business. It was people making games that if three of their friends thought it was fun, they figured they had a mass market hit. And we helped so many developers and publishers in those early days figure out if their games were right for the retail shelves, for getting into stores. That was really how I got my start in all of gaming.
And what was the name of the company that you joined after AT&T?
The name of the company was Navar, a little company based in Minneapolis, but we're doing things in home video distribution, did things in music distribution, and with the advent of software coming into more of a mass market, becoming less specialty and specialized more in the mass market, a big opportunity for us to distinguish ourselves in the gaming realm, and that's really how I got my start.
And what was the future of that company?
That company was actually absorbed by a big distribution company. Part of it still exists today, but it was bought and purchased by another software distribution company that became a behemoth in selling software in the United States. When I mean software, I mean music software, home video software, as well as gaming software, and had presence for all the big retailers, Walmart and Target and Best Buy, GameStop. In those days, it was referred to as software, et cetera. And so my entry into gaming was really from the publishing side, the business side, the sales, marketing, licensing, and distribution side. It was a great way to learn the business, to get involved with the business. I think about all the friendships that I have from those days. We were all salespeople. We were in the buyer's offices or in the waiting rooms of the buyer's offices, becoming friends. And now some of them, they run Microsoft, gaming, Xbox. One runs PlayStation. A number that now are heads of publishers like Electronic Arts and Take-Two. So
you got a pretty good network now.
I have a good network. Also comes along with being in the business for a while, but I consider them some of my best friends, and I think it's safe to say we all had a hand in building the gaming business into what it is today.
Yeah, that is great, and like having a strong network, right? You can't really ask for more, and the experience also. It comes throughout the time.
The one thing about the gaming business that has stood the test of time is that people are very accessible and available, and everybody, what's the phrase, rising tides lift all boats. That is the sort of the thought and the sentiment that permeates all of gaming, that just because you might have a competing product or a competing product line or a competing brand. Everybody in the space has been so available for building the business overall, and you can see the effects of that now. I think it's safe to say that number of us on the ground floor never thought gaming would be what the global phenomenon it is now, and I can say that safely for myself. There are much smarter people in the space that maybe saw this coming, but when we started, I always thought gaming was going to be an interesting business. It was going to be a lucrative business, but never did I think it would grow to be the global dominance and the global sort of a cultural change that has occurred as a result of it becoming such a large dynamic.
I got it. And what were your next steps from that company?
After I left that company, our model was really distribution. Mm-hmm. But from that, my interest really turned to publishing. And publishing, again, meaning it's really the business side of the game business, the you know, sales, marketing, distribution, licensing, going to market with gaming. And after I left Navarre, I went to a company called GT Interactive. And if again, well before your time, but GT Interactive in the United States was very seminal in proliferating segment of gaming that became a strong nucleus. And by that, I mean the first-person shooters. We controlled, essentially had a monopoly in the marketplace for first-person shooter games. Quake, Doom, Duke Nukem, Unreal, those were all games that were published under our brand, GT Interactive, and is really, in those days, propelled the gaming business and propelled the adoption of gaming on the PC platform. And in those days, it was largely PC that was propelling it. But shortly thereafter, a lot of these franchises made their way to the console platforms in the early days. You know, PlayStation got out in front of Xbox, but Nintendo was out well before PlayStation. So that's this publishing realm where I really got my start on being closer to the games and closer to the intellectual property around the games. That is what fueled me to where I am today.
And then GT Interactive was acquired?
GT Interactive, in 1999, there was a very similar company to GT Interactive in Europe. GT Interactive was largely North American, almost predominantly U.S., but some extensions into Canada and extensions into Mexico. But a very similar company was in a parallel path to GT Interactive on the European side, and that company was called Infogrames. Many people in Europe will remember Infogrames. It wasn't a brand name as much as it was a company name, mm-hmm. and had many successful franchises. The models between GT Interactive and Infogrames were very similar, both publishing and distribution. In the case of GT Interactive, really North American centric. In the case of Infogrames, really European centric. The merger of those companies was a natural, and that happened in late 1998 to 1999. And I became the head of publishing, of sales, marketing, mm-hmm. distribution for the combined entity in that era. And then shortly thereafter, we bought the interactive division, of gaming from Hasbro. Big toy company, massively successful in certain franchises between things like Monopoly and Clue and a lot of board games, but also had the foresight in the mid 90s to buy from Warner Brothers the Atari brand, and the Atari brand was sitting rather dormant. In the IP, in the selection of IP at Hasbro,
and so you bought just the brand.
We bought everything in the portfolio.
Yeah, I got it. But part of it was the Atari brand.
We bought the Atari brand as part of the. And remember, the funny thing was, we were doing the due diligence on the acquisition, and we were sitting in the room with a room full of attorneys, and we've got all their assets in front of us and looking through the list. And I went right to the list of all the different titles. And I was like, what? There's Atari? and everybody looked around and they said, well, yeah, they own Atari. I said, well, Atari's one of the best brands in the world. It was in the 70s and 80s. It was second only to Coca-Cola in terms of global brand power and presence. And at the time, Atari at that point was really unpoliced. There was a lot of Atari knockoffs in the marketplace. The branding was everywhere, which was a good thing. It wasn't it wasn't a bad thing. It kept the brand alive and kept the sort of in a pirated way. It became cool again, and so when we saw that it put a lot of thought in everybody's head. No, how do we bring this brand back? How do we attach ourselves to the brand? How do we celebrate the legacy of Atari while bringing it into a more contemporary state? And then we completed the acquisition in 2000, and then in 2003. When the company name we did adopt was Infogram, when GT Interactive went away, we adopted Infogram. But that was also, people in the U.S. couldn't pronounce it. They would thought it was spelled Infograms, and it wasn't a great brand name. So it was an easy decision to say, well, we're going to bring the Atari brand back, and we renamed
it. Because it was the best name.
It was right? the best name. But also, you think about something that has a legacy like that, there's also some risk, people won't get it. They won't attach to it. They'll think that it's old gaming, not new gaming. And so we had a challenge to not only, as I mentioned, not only celebrate its legacy and to build on its legacy, but to bring a more contemporary feel, more contemporary gaming to the brand. And for the longest time, we did refer to it as the new Atari. That Atari company still exists today. It's really mostly a licensing shell that takes all of the legacy properties and anything new, and will license it for mobile, for toys, there's an effort around soft drinks, Atari brand soft drinks. So. That continues to this day for Atari, but it was a really interesting time to when we renamed the company in 2003. I got to stand at the NASDAQ. Our company was public. The Infogram stock was being traded on the NASDAQ exchange, and we changed the name one day, and I got to ring the you push a button on the NASDAQ.
You don't
ring a bell. You in NASDAQ, you push a button, and when the stock went live that morning, it came out as the Atari ATAR, and our stock doubled based on just the brand change alone. It was didn't last long, but the power of the brand really propelled it. It looked like an IPO, and it was part of reinvigorating and relaunching Atari in a more contemporary way.
Do you feel like that was a brave move?
It was brave. I don't know that was brave. I think it was such a strong brand and such a great association with gaming. It was
just
kind
sense.
Of a no-brainer. Was. So I don't know.
Because previously you said that there is some risks associated with taking an existing brand that has the legacy.
I think it became the name change alone was easy decision, but what was difficult was making this legacy brand become more contemporary, and that really happened after the fact. It was part of the plan to attach Atari to new franchises. The Matrix game, you might remember, was wildly successful. That was ours. Yep. It came out on the Atari brand. We had the Terminator titles that were on the Atari brand. We had a prior franchise called Driver. I don't know if you remember Driver in the day. It was a very, very much a groundbreaking sort of game that had driving AI up until that point hadn't happened before. And the third and fourth iterations of Driver came out on the Atari brand. So we were thoughtful and very, very considerate about the brand. We have a lot of respect for it. But we did have to navigate the waters pretty well to make sure we weren't being inauthentic and trying to bring some luster to something that had lost its luster. So,
was there any legacy of Steve Jobs at Atari?
No, I can't think of any of that he was that his legacy attached to. So no, not at all. We didn't think twice about Steve Jobs in those days. He had his own big company to deal with.
That's right. And like I had a chance to drive the new Tesla Model 3.
Yes.
And there is like a couple of hidden secrets, and part of that is also Atari games,
that's,
I believe.
You're exactly right. I was unaware of that until I was being driven by a friend of mine in a Tesla, and she showed me they were gaming on the, and I was blown away. I had no idea that was happening, but that's a really cool thing.
I could not still figure out how to unlock the games, but I know that there is the Atari icon.
And I don't know that I did either, but she knew how to do it, and we were, as she was driving, I was playing.
So, nice. Yeah. Nice. And your sort of work at Atari over the 7 years you have been with the company, did it progress, or you kind of were working on the same? What was the sort of progress of your role within Atari?
Well, it's interesting, and this is maybe getting to the topic of the safe versus brave. I early on saw so many different things starting to happen to the game business, and I wasn't alone. Everybody, the market was sensing that there was big changes afoot, and largely from the perspective of distribution. And we got involved, and this is, I'll get to the point of where I think this is part of a brave position that I took and that my team took within Atari, is that we got behind in a big way, and when other companies weren't, the whole notion of digital distribution. We were seeing it. Music at that point had already been well established. Books were starting to distribute electronically, and it was only—I mean, it didn't take a rocket scientist to see this was also going to come for software for gaming. But what was brave about it is we pushed the envelope early. We aligned with a number of different digital platforms to make sure. Pardon me, our games were available digitally, mm-hmm. and in a number of different formats, either as a download or as a stream. That was early. We were quite early in that. And the risk there was that our retail customers, the Walmarts of the world, they hated that, because all of a sudden we were going direct to consumer, not through the retailers.
Them.
And they, Walmart and number of other retailers saw what we were doing, and they threatened to take our products off the shelves because we were undermining them. We were going around them and going direct to the consumer. Yet, as you see now,
that's the only way.
It's the only way. And we were quite early in that. And I had to, you know, really look myself in the mirror a few times. Are we doing the right thing? Are we going to be losing business as a result of this decision? We were able to manage through it. We were able to find the balance. And now, you know, in those days, we were light years ahead of everybody else when it came to the notion of a customer dealing with directly with us through a digital means for purchase. I think that qualifies as being somewhat brave and
for sure. Like if you are the early mover in the industry, right? That's definitely right. Something that is a sign of a brave move.
And to take that just one step further, that for me was sort of the beginning of the end of the traditional model, at least as far as I was concerned. I got enamored with online gaming as a result, not just the distribution of, but the play of online too.
There is a whole new sort of era that started
exactly,
for you right after.
Exactly right. And so I ended up leaving Atari when the traditional model and the traditional dynamics where it still had companies like Atari in its grip. I decided to go start my own company. Mm-hmm. And it was all about online gaming, both from a digital distribution perspective, but also
The competition
and massively multiplayer online games becoming a big thing. We part of our company was devoted to bringing Korean games into the U.S. marketplace, but localizing them not just in language but also in play styles and play modes. So that was my company. We called it Elephant Entertainment. We had three founders. We were running this out of Minneapolis. We did everything from casual games on the distribution platform. We had a partner called Oberon that in those days was the big player in digital distribution around casual games. Mm-hmm. You might remember there was a big breakout of casual games in the 2008, 2009 timeframe. And what we did was built on this platform. We built ecosystems for each of the retailers so they could also be part of the digital experience. We ended up giving them, we put a digital store on the Walmart brand. We did a digital store on the Best Buy brand. And for every time they promoted it, they didn't have to carry any inventory. This was their brand associating with a new dynamic, a new way to consume software. We would give them a rev share for every purchase that happened and became very aligned. It wasn't our brand we were building, it was really building their brand in a new model in a new space. So that was part of our business. And then the other side was more hardcore gaming in the MMO space. And everything we did was online.
And did that business perform well?
It performed well. In 2 short years we ended up getting purchased by a big publisher called THQ.
That's what you want.
Well, we didn't necessarily start out that way, but when we were in market for our second year in 2008, and you might remember, that's when the markets crashed. And in the United States, the commercial real estate market crashed, the residential real estate market crashed, and it caused everything to plummet with it. You might remember the banks were in distress. That was the time when we were in the market trying to raise money for our company. So needless to say, we couldn't raise any money given all these massive dynamics that were happening. And instead, THQ approached us and said, we'd buy you. They didn't have an online strategy. They didn't have a digital distribution model. They were grasping to figure something out. They bought my company, Elephant, to come in and be their online strategy. So we not only did our casual our stores with the retailers, but we also did we brought them into the MMO space, and we brought over a couple games from Korea that were localized, and we're able to get THQ into the online space. So that was but we were able to take this asset. If we hadn't been the markets hadn't been so decimated, I think we could have built it into a really big business on our own. But we had this nice backstop with a publisher, and we fit an area that they had no knowledge of and didn't have any expertise. So it worked out in a really nice way.
At what point did you see that esports is going to be a big thing? What was when was it? Because you were one of the first people in the industry probably to realize that and to make a bet on it. What year?
Well, that was approximately. Well, this was not long after THQ bought our Elephant Entertainment, and more my company Elephant was being absorbed by THQ, which is their right. You know, they bought the company; they could do with it what they want. And it was becoming less my company, more their company. And as a result, I started to pay attention to what was happening in the marketplace outside of my realm, and was seeing really early signs of, boy, this competitive gaming thing is interesting. We saw it in the early days as a very grassroots. The biggest example of this is in 2009, early 2009, I became aware of this movement of players, kids, taking their Xboxes, unplugging them, driving to a hotel in in Tallahassee, Florida, and having 40 of their friends or 40 people that they knew all convene there. Everybody put in $100. They'd land their Xboxes together and they'd play Madden competitively. And I kept hearing about this and seeing it happen around the country. And I said, well, there's got to be a better way to do this. You don't have to unpack your Xbox. You don't have to drive 200 miles. You don't have to rent a hotel room to put it all together. It's a horrible experience. There's got to be a platform solution here.
I remember these days when I was traveling with my desktop computer under my shoulder and going to a friend's house for a day or two to basically compete.
That was the dynamic that we saw when this was 2009. You know, online was well established and well developed at that point. So it was a matter of us saying we can build a technology solution for this. So the two young guys that found me, the three of us put together a business plan, and my role, they were the technology guys. My role was really the partnership side. I knew everybody in the business, knew the key guys at Microsoft and at Sony and at Nintendo and at Electronic Arts and 2K, our early partners in this. And by 2010, we were ready to launch. And it was really around, and you'll recall 2010, the word esports didn't exist, but we knew there was this online play community that really wanted to compete and had no real means by which to do it. So we were about ready to launch in early 2010. We didn't have any partners. When you work with a particular publisher's game, you have to have their approval to do it. But we were in the zeal to launch, in the haste to launch, we didn't have partners. We were going to talk about our technology, use it as the means by which to then engage with publishers. And then something really funny happened as we were getting ready to launch. We were approached by a gentleman out of Canada who was running Virgin Mobile in Canada, and as he heard about our proposition that we were going to have this competitive play platform that in those days had some money aspects to it, he said, "Does Richard know?" He said, "Does Richard know about this?" And I said, "Richard who?" And he said, "Well, Richard Branson." And I said, "Well, I don't know Richard Branson." And he said, "Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, this is a model that he would love, that you're taking an existing business and an existing paradigm and turning it on its head. It's now competitive. You can play for money. You can play in tournaments. There's prize pools." He said, "This hasn't existed before." And they said, "Well, you know, we don't know Richard at all." He said, "Well, I'll introduce you." 10 days later, we were sitting in Richard Branson's office in London, and he said to us, "I want to buy the company." And we said, "Well, it's not for sale. But you know, we'd love to have you as an investor." And long story, we tried to get an investor deal done with his corporate dev team, couldn't get it done. And finally he said, let's cut a deal. I'll give you the use of the license, the Virgin license, in exchange for a favorable valuation on my personal investment." So that was the case. That's what we did. And we finally launched at E3 in 2010 as Virgin Gaming. Now, it was a great way to get started. I won't bore you with all the details. It really helped us get going with a established brand and established name. And we were, that E3, were on the cover of the New York Times. We were on the cover of Wall Street Journal saying betting and wagering had now come to video gaming. And that wasn't... It was a provocative story and a controversial story, which ultimately proved to be a good service to us. But it wasn't exactly what we were after. But it did. It all of a sudden, you know, the publishers took notice. The Sony took notice. By the fall, we had deals in place with EA, with NBA 2K, with Capcom, with a number of other publishers that enabled us to use their games, their intellectual property on our platform. and enable people to play competitively one another. We had to do some in-game integration in order to accomplish that, but it really enabled us to get off the ground. And we, our very first activation was in the FIFA game. FIFA game is, as I've been telling you, Lubo, I love, and I don't play it. I play it, but I'm not very good. In any event, when we had our integration in FIFA, the first night, their ticker, as everybody will remember in the older days, there were tickers in the game.
Yeah.
And the ticker that night said, join, we had it called, the, it was a lobby in the drop-down menu in the game, join the Virgin Gaming lobby and play FIFA for money. And that first night, we got over 7,000 registrations for our platform. That meant a complete registration with a credit card, and we thought we couldn't lose. After that, it was a matter of all the games that we work with to get in-game integration and then to market to the players through the game. There's no better way to market to a player, obviously, of a game than through the game. So,
right.
So we for the next 3 years really pushed this model of tournament play that had money aspects to it, both head to head as well as bracketed tournaments and entry fee based tournaments. At one point in time, we had an integration with on Xbox that our platform essentially was residing on the Xbox Live platform. Very complicated, far beyond my pay grade. Thankfully, we had some really good engineers who figured out the right way to do it. But then one of the problems became as this business grew, was sponsors wanted to be involved, which is great. You know, sponsorship means more money. It means more attention, means more presence. And unfortunately, we kept running into brand problems with the Virgin brand. Best example was we were in 2014, there was a World Cup, you might remember.
Mm-hmm.
We had planned with Electronic Arts to be alongside of the traditional World Cup with our own World Cup, an online version of the World Cup. It was going to mirror the World Cup in every way that we could. And after 8 months of planning, we were all set to, we were about a month away from launching. Maybe it was more like 60 days away from launching. And the gentleman who was running the FIFA franchise at EA called me and said, we have a problem. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he said, well, FIFA doesn't like the Virgin brand. I said, why not? And he said, well, every time they see Virgin, they see an airline. And every year, FIFA sells a $200 million sponsorship to Emirates, and Emirates, when they see Virgin, they see an airline. They don't want any part of it. So, I thought we were going to be able to negotiate our way out of it and to bring some rational thinking, but we ended up not getting it. We had to flush 8 months of work down the drain, and it's funny how that sort of became. There were more and more and more brand conflicts that emerged for Virgin, not Virgin's fault, and certainly not our fault, but just a market dynamic that. Well, so we ended up in a
huge group of companies under one umbrella brand, right?
That's so. Exactly right, and the model for Virgin is to take an existing platform or an existing business model and turn it on its head. That's exactly what.
Yep.
And that's what Richard, that was how he built an empire, using the Virgin brand to contemporize or to change the experience around a particular product or service. And so for us, we had an amicable parting of the ways. We said, we're sorry, but as sponsorship was becoming a bigger part of how we monetize, we couldn't lose sponsors. We needed to have every potential sponsor we could. So we ended up giving the brand back to Virgin. We went back into the marketplace in 2014 as our original company name, which is World Gaming. And from there, the rest is kind of history.
That's an amazing story, all the way to this point. But there is one really interesting aspect, and it's the sort of the live tournaments that we did not talk about a whole lot, and it seems like this is getting more and more popular. And also, like the thing that you mentioned with FIFA and with the World Championship, right? You wanted to sort of make it exactly the same, And I think that this is actually what's happening with esports, because it in my like opinion, it copies every single pattern of the real sports.
You're not wrong at all. I think the rise of esports can give credit to traditional sports, because the more esports evolves and matures, it starts to look an awful lot like traditional sports. This past year, 2018 was a big year in that regard. So the big, you know, the most elite leagues on the planet now, Overwatch League and the LCS, the League of Legends league that is franchise based, are now looking a lot like traditional sports. You know, these leagues are now, they have their franchises in cities that play franchises in other cities. They're part of a full season, a preseason, a regular season, a postseason, and a championship. You may not understand what Overwatch is, but when you see that structure, you say, "Boy, it looks an awful lot like Premier League, or it looks an awful lot like the NBA, or it looks a lot like the NFL," where that construct, people understand that. They understand traditional sports in that regard. Again, you may not understand the game, but by understanding the structure, you're getting close. You're getting much closer than you are, and that's important for the general population. That's important for the media. That's important for brands to now start to understand that. And that's what happened in 2018. That's why. Seems 2018 for me, we've been doing this for a number of years now, but was really a breakout year, and it was the mass market understanding that has propelled esports now to its next level. And you know, the esports audience has always been large, and it's grown year over year. What's interesting is that the traditional mainstream, I'll oppose and I'll argue that there are two mainstreams. There's the traditional mainstream, people with cable subscriptions and older than 30, and you know, very very sort of traditionally media knowledgeable. You contrast that to the new mainstream, and the new mainstream digital native, you know, under 30. Largely playing games. They don't consume media in a traditional way. They don't go to movies. They don't watch. They don't have cable subscription. Never had a cable. They're not only cord cutters. They're cord neverers. They and
no cords.
No cords at all. And when they're online, which they are a lot, largely they're playing games. And not only are they playing games, but they're watching games. And they're watching it on Twitch. And they're watching it on other platforms. Now YouTube going to a more streaming model. YouTube has been a great supporter of gaming from a video on demand perspective, but now they're getting involved in streaming. New platforms like Huya and Duyo that are Chinese based now coming to North America and coming to Europe. They are now propelling content around gameplay that becomes also you know, very very desirable, very consumable by the non-traditional mainstream or the new mainstream. And now what's really interesting is that they for the longest period of time they've been in parallel, but now they're starting to intersect. They're intersecting you see ESPN now covering the Overwatch League. You see Turner broadcasting in the United States, also broadcasting its own leagues. And those are cable-based programming. You're sitting in your home watching on your television. You're getting the content that way. But also now you can say the same thing on Twitch. And the more the traditional adopts the esports content and makes that intersection, that's a good thing. That's an inflection point that now brings a bigger audience and maybe more importantly, than being a big audience, it's an audience that now has an understanding about esports, and they don't see it as foreign, and they don't see it as something they don't grasp or understand. It's all helping. You know, back to my rising tides lift all boats. The same thing is happening as these dynamics start intersecting and coming together.
Do you feel like esports industry could be one day bigger than the real sports?
I think so. And you know, the thing about esports, it's no different than traditional sports. There's the game of, you know, football, which is and it's and the pro side of the NFL, at least in the U.S. There's the game of basketball. The pro side is the NBA, at least in the U.S. In you know, you make an analogy. There's the Overwatch League, which is there's 35 million people playing that game. I don't know how many people are playing the NBA game, but what makes it so easy to get big and to scale is that it's all online. It's all digital. You need a computer, yes, but most people this day and age have a computer, or you need a phone, and you know, billions of phones in the hands of people and players in the world. So I do think it will get bigger than traditional sports, even in an amalgamated way. I think just the ease of play, the access to play, and the proliferation of devices in such a global fashion will make it bigger than traditional sports.
And it seems also like that these days esports is making its way to colleges and college campuses, right? How important is it for the colleges to play a role in this game?
Well, back to what I was saying earlier, the 2018 being an important year as the pro side of esports gets clarified, and this past year, given the advent of the leagues, as I mentioned, was really helpful in clarifying and explaining esports to the broader audience. As the pro sides get defined and more clarified, it really defines what we're all about. And between World Gaming and our other brand, Collegiate Star League, we're about the amateur side. And the pro sides have gotten a lot of momentum without a well-established developmental side, the grassroots side, feeder systems, laddering up. So much of that is still left to chance, whereby our business model is to organize that, to galvanize that, when we work with publishers. Best example is we do a lot of work with Activision and MLG. Our Call of Duty event, past 4 years, has always been about amateurs, getting the amateur teams involved. But what's important for the amateurs is to see that they can have a path to the pros, that through access to play, access to content, access to events, they see now that there is a connection to the pros, and that's what we're enabling. So when we do our Call of Duty event, Activision, what MLG, who runs the leagues for Call of Duty, the World League, what they'll give us is that the winning team coming out of our event will get a seat in one of their majors, one of their pro majors. So we really are walking like we talk and saying that we'll through our events, through our content, through access to all of our programming, if you're aspiring to get better, we can help you get better. And if you do really well in our events, you'll get that leap, you'll get that jump into the pro ranks. So more and more and more, that's the opportunity in the space. Goldman Sachs published not long ago a report that said they were surprised at how much momentum the pro side of esports has gotten without a well-established developmental side, and then further went on to say, not only is there a big opportunity there, but there are great investment opportunities on the developmental side. So we feel pretty good about where we are and how we can help build this business even to a much bigger extent.
How do colleges look at pro gamers, and how do they value them versus pro athletes? And I'm not saying pro, but like on the college level, right? Because there is now even like college teams and
yes. Well, and that, and I'll talk about that for a bit. We have a brand called Collegiate Star League. We're the largest footprint in collegiate esports in North America. We have 1,600 plus schools involved with our different leagues. Every game, as you can imagine, is a league. So we have a Dota 2 league, we have a Counter-Strike league, we have a League of Legends league, we have a Madden league, we have an NBA 2K league, we have a Street Fighter league. Every one of those games becomes its own league. And the dynamic is our schools playing schools, teams of kids representing their schools, no different than if you're at the University of Michigan and are on the football team. University of Michigan has a Dota 2 team. And these teams, we through our league, through the structure that we've created, we manage the league. We're no different than the NCAA in that regard. As we put the schedules together, we pit the teams against the teams. We publish the standings. We publish content. The college scene is a really big scene for esports. It didn't start that way really. The last 3 years has gotten a lot of momentum, and the smart schools are recognizing that esports is important to them, because kids who play esports are some of the brightest STEM students on the planet, brightest science, tech, technology, engineering, and math students. And the smart schools are using their esports, are developing esports programs and using them to recruit the best and the brightest. So what we do is give them all the tools to help them bring those activations to life for their schools. That's cool things happening. There's, you know, in the United States, big rivalries at the college level. Ohio State and Michigan, you know, it's one good example. Now there are new rivalries developing on the esports side. University of British Columbia and Robert Morris in the last 3 years have been in the finals of our League of Legends league, a rivalry. I mean, a bona fide rivalry around a different kind of game, obviously, and two schools that wouldn't know one another if it weren't for our league. So it's a great space. I think to the second part of your question, Lubo, about the pro side of things, there in esports, there's still is quite a blur between who's a pro and who's an amateur. You don't in traditional sports, it's pretty clear cut. If you're, you know, especially in college, you're not a pro. But you know what happens when you're out of college? First thing you want to do is become a pro. If you're a good player, you want to be drafted. You want to be a pro. And that's starting to happen now more and more. But there isn't a prohibition. If you're playing in college, there's not a prohibition against playing in a pro event. I don't see that changing anytime soon, but as the pro ranks get more defined, that will become more clear. And, you know, in the Overwatch League, if you're a pro player now, you are prohibited from playing in non-pro events. So it's going to happen one way or the other. It's going to get there eventually. We're still so early in the maturation and the evolution of esports, but that is the difference. And the other cool thing that we do when we're in market for our collegiate leagues, we get a lot of interest from sponsors, and the proceeds we garner from sponsorships, we will take proceeds from the sponsorships and pay them out and prizing at the end of the year for the college teams, but we pay them out of scholarships. We don't pay them out in they were actually paying the tuition for the players on the team or paying a partial. We don't necessarily cover the entire tuition, but we'll cover a chunk of it, and that's coming out through the scholarships we award. And we think it's the right thing to do. It keeps the ecosystem intact. It makes sure the kids stay involved, get their degrees, and. The other great thing that's happening in college campuses that it's growing not just to be a participation, but also a curriculum. You know that you don't have to necessarily be a really good player in order to be involved in the sport, in the business of esports. You marketing programs, a media program, production programs, all are gearing now towards esports as a business. And we've had a hand in bringing that to light and working with the schools to make sure that they're focused on and are building the proper curriculum and the proper support for esports as a business and as a subject matter on their as part of their schools.
What do you need to become a great esports player? What's the skill set that you need to make it to the top?
Well, you know, first and foremost, mental focus and mental acuity are probably amongst the biggest. You know, a player's ability to have a strong mind and not be fatigued, because these games are intense. They're Your head's down for an hour and a half. Nonstop action with some stops, but by and large, it's like split seconds, playing chess with split second moves, and being able to translate that into wrist and hand and hand eye sort of coordination. So the training along those lines and performance enhancement along those lines are really, really important. Most of the pro teams now have not just performance, they have coaches, but they also have performance enhancers that aren't not necessarily about the skill of the game, but just stay keeping focused and keeping your mind on what you need to do. It's a fascinating thing that's happening. Nutrition. Most of these
is there a special kind of nutrition for esports players?
They're no different than you might. Well, we were talking about this last night. Then remember, you're too young to remember, but in the early days of golf, in professional golf, the golfers were on the course. They were smoking cigarettes. They had their stomachs hanging over their belts. they were anything but conditioned. Now you see PGA players today. There's amongst the best conditioned athletes on the planet, and the recognition that you have to have a solid body and have to be a healthy body in order to have a healthy mind. That's now what's happening with esports. Still a ways to go in that regard, and you know, it's aerobic exercise is just as important when you need to stay focused. Then having the mental capacity to perform and to stay focused. So it is training is a really important thing for the professional esport athlete.
It's great to hear basically the entire transition from like throughout your career from like programming that you did not really enjoy to gaming all the way to and then also licensing and distribution all the way to esports and online gaming and competitions and everything. It's a great story, and I think I definitely see the path that you followed. What I'd like to ask now is because that's what we started with. What points were the most difficult for you throughout that journey, and where did you have to decide whether you wanna take the safe route or whether you want to be brave and really achieve something and really go after your goals?
I touched on it briefly. I didn't talk about it in quite those terms, but when I had sold my company to THQ and it was clear that they were going to do with my business, I still thought of it as my business, with what they needed to do. That was a challenge for me. I had built a business. I was invested in the business, not only financially, but also emotionally. And when it was clear to me that was waning and was going away, that was a challenge to me. I didn't like being disintermediated. I didn't like losing control. And it was a dark time for me. But I also think because it really allowed me and forced me to reassess, you know, what I wanted to do and what I thought my value was and what I thought my vision was, it propelled me towards esports. And again, at that point in time, we didn't know it was going to be a big thing. But to me, it felt like it was the right time. And this notion of playing, I've been involved in video gaming enough, this notion about playing for stakes and for to excel and really putting some consideration at play, that seemed to me, it felt to me like it was the next big thing in gaming, and I went all in as evidenced here. It could have gone many different ways. Like I said, I think we had a pretty big hand in those early days of helping build it and bring it to life. But that was, we weren't sure. There were, you know, two, three years where we all felt like we had the right thing. We were aligned in our vision. We were aligned in our mission. But we weren't sure. We were still proving out things that were largely theoretical. And good news was, I think we all trusted as we saw it started to take off, we trusted our instincts. We trusted that we had the right gut, that we had the right approach, that we understood the gamer enough that we were on the right track. But there were clearly were some very many sleepless nights when we were wondering if we were on the right path.
Do you feel that this kind of a mindset is important when you want to reach certain success or reach your goals, or do you think that there is another path to get
no,
there?
No, I think especially with a technology-based business that can change dramatically in you know 2 months' time, you have to be thinking about what's happening next, and that isn't always. That's not for everybody. That's not for those who, and there's nothing wrong with a safe career and a safe path. There are ups and downs with and a big roller coaster when you take the brave route, I think, by and large, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. It's been exciting. It's been fun. I think I mentioned last night, I've never had more fun. Been in the game business for a long time. I've never had more fun than what's happening right now, and I do attribute it to the fact that we have stayed true to our vision. We've stayed true to what we believe will be the next big thing, and I feel so fortunate that I've been able to do that.
It's awesome to see the energy that is coming from you, that like you have really clearly in your head sorted out what you want to achieve, and you are just going after it. And I know that you are a very busy man. You travel a lot. Every 2-3 days you are in different city, state or country. How do you deal with that, and how do you source that huge amount of energy that you have?
Well, I guess I've never really thought about it in those terms. First of all, I am passionate about it. I think esports is changing the world in so many ways, and I might be a little biased because I'm invested emotionally and financially in the space. But I see that it is changing the world, and I see when we talk to gamers and we see what our events do for them, how it's fulfilling their passion, fulfilling their dreams. That's to me is completely engaging and energizing. And there's so much still to be had in this business. There's so much room for growth and so many opportunities to build this business into I stay awake at night in a good way. Thinking about what happens next, and how what it is we're doing and how what it is I'm doing can help move it to the next level. So that's what it is. I also, you know, we were talking about the athlete side or the pro athlete side of esports. I have to think the same way. You know, I'm not an athlete. I need to have energy. I'm in a youthful business and I'm not young anymore, but I take care of myself. I watch what I eat. As we talked over dinner last night, I have to stay light on my feet, and that all goes into being an energetic person in the space, but I'll bring it all back. The passion for me is helping this business build, and that to me is what's so energizing and so engaging for my work.
If there is one thing that you could inspire people to decide for the brave path, what would the brave whim recommend?
I faced a lot of this as we were making this big play into the competitive gaming side. Is you have to challenge everything. You have to challenge the conventional thinking. You have to challenge the status quo. And I think you Lubo and your company, that you do that every single day. That as you're in a technology business, there's always better ways to do things, and the only way you find them is to challenge what is at that point conventional and traditional thinking. And I would encourage everybody, the young people I work with now, they challenge everything. And I didn't grow up that way. I grew up okay. You're there are sacred cows that you have to bow down to. It's a funny story, but in as we got into a deep program with Microsoft, Microsoft was flexing their muscle and they, you know, didn't like what some of the things we were working on, and the young guys would say, well, screw Microsoft, we don't need Microsoft. It's, well, yeah, we do kind of need Microsoft for Xbox, but their point was that we'll challenge anything. We'll challenge any authority that we think gets in the way of us completing and fulfilling our vision. So that would be that isn't original. That isn't a new thinking, but it really has. It is now part of the dynamic of building a business and to sustaining a business in the technological world. And I would absolutely endorse that's the right way to be approaching business in this day and age.
So basically, be think unconventionally.
Think unconventionally and act unconventionally. If your gut is telling you in this particular day and age to go counter, you should listen to your gut. It may not work out all the time, but you have enough swings at the bat, you're going to do better more times than not.
Are you active on social media?
I'm a little bit active on social media. My social media is really more B2B. And so I do a lot of on LinkedIn to really help our partners see what's happening in the space and keep them abreast of what we're doing and active in the space. It's funny how that has proven to be a good approach. I'll let the Instagram and the Facebooks and the Twitter to the rest of our social media team. But for me, and that's more B2C, really more building our brand with the customer, building our engagement with the players in our audience. But for me, where I can be authentic, I can't be authentic on Instagram, but I can be on LinkedIn, and it's proving to be a good tool for us as we proselytize what we're doing and get more people involved.
So WIMS Talks on LinkedIn, it's the place where people can find you, learn more about you, and follow you.
I welcome all to find me on LinkedIn. I will likely accept your invitation.
All right, Wim, thank you so much for joining us for the podcast. It's been very inspiring, and once again, thank you, and it's been a pleasure to have you and talking to you.
Thank you, Lubo, for hosting me in Prague, my first time in Prague, and I'm enjoying myself and the Czech Republic immensely. So thank you very much.
I hope that you have enjoyed the podcast. I'll be more than happy if you share with me your feedback through likes or reviews. Otherwise, you can reach me through my site, lubosmith.com, lubosmid.com.